Hello and welcome to this Monday edition of Banfield Tonight. The man who allegedly broke into the San Francisco home of Speaker Nancy Pelosi and assaulted her husband, Paul, is facing a very long list of both state and federal charges that could lock him away for life. This is the man that they've hauled in. Both local police and the feds are sharing new and graphic details about the harrowing ordeal that Paul Pelosi went through inside that San Francisco home. The feds were the first to bring the charges, quote, assault on the immediate family member of a federal official and attempted kidnapping of a federal official. The first charge could mean 30 years in prison. The second, 20 years. And early this evening, the San Francisco DA added a whole bunch more charges to the list. 42-year-old Paul DePape is also facing attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, burglary, threatening family members of public officials, false imprisonment, and elder abuse. Authorities say they have no doubt this attack was politically motivated and that Paul Pelosi had no prior connection to or association with his attacker. The details that came out today in news conferences and court papers are reminiscent of both January 6th and the failed attempt to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Joining me now with more on all of this is News Nation investigative correspondent Rich McHugh, who's in San Francisco tonight. And Rich, the man that they arrested seemed to speak at length about his plans, but what exactly did he tell the police?
Good evening, Ashley. So the Department of Justice filed charges today, and as part of that, their supporting documents laid out what it answered a lot of questions. Basically, the San Francisco police interviewed this guy after his arrest, and he talked about the attack, the harrowing details. He also talked about motive and basically, in his own words, admitted that this was politically motivated on his part. Here's what we know now, and I want to read from the charges. Today, the Department of Justice charged David DePape with assault and attempted kidnapping. The kidnapping charge carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison, and the assault charge carries a maximum sentence of 30 years. According to court documents, DePape brought with him a roll of tape, white rope, zip ties, two hammers. We also have new information about his motive after the arrest. Police interviewed him. He said he intended to question Speaker Pelosi. He intended to hold Speaker Pelosi hostage, and he said if she told the truth, he'd let her go. But if she lied to him, he'd break her kneecaps. And further, he said Pelosi is the, quote, leader of the pack of lies told by the Democratic Party. The complaint says DePape told investigators, quote, by breaking Nancy's kneecaps, she would then have to be wheeled into Congress, which would show other members of Congress there were consequences to action. Here in San Francisco, the local district attorney held a presser a few hours ago. So in addition to the federal charges against DePape, he is now charged with attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, first-degree burglary, threatening family members of public officials, false imprisonment, and abuse of an elder. Her office believes all the charges were politically motivated. One other bit of news, we're reporting that DePape is a Canadian citizen here on an expired visa, according to one law enforcement source. The suspect will be arraigned in court here tomorrow, and the district attorney has filed a motion to have him detained so he cannot go on bail, Ashley.
Yeah, no bail, saying that he's so dangerous to the community. Here are all these pictures we're seeing of this guy. It seems like he's at a lot of nudist events. And I know a lot of right-wing and left-wing critics have sort of jumped on this, saying he's a lefty liberal, don't blame the right. And then the police have said, actually, if you look into a lot of his online activity, it's pretty associated with some far-right, you know, conspiracy theories and the like, right?
Well, there's sort of this divided picture of him, as you kind of referred to it. Like, one of the neighbors spoke about him and said he's left-leaning and he's a nudist activist and a drug abuser. And then you read about some of the things that he's posted online and certainly what he told authorities in this instance. And it's pretty clear that this attack was motivated, directly. He was targeting Nancy Pelosi and wanted to make a statement about, you know, the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and he's also very anti-Semitic, according to his online posting, saying that, you know, Auschwitz didn't gas anybody and has all sorts of, you know, Adolf Hitler speeches, etc. One of the things that I wanted to go over here really quickly was the story of what happened inside the Pelosi's house. Like, it was 2:23 in the morning, and he smashes his way through the glass back door. And then where did he go from there, and what happened in this, you know, dark house in the, you know, deep, dark depths of the nighttime?
So if I understand it correctly, a lot of this information has come out over the past couple of days. There are multiple pressers, but if I understand it correctly, he broke in the window in the back, on the lower floor in the back. He went in the house, and he went up to the Pelosi bedroom where he encountered Paul Pelosi, who was sleeping. Woke him up, got him up. He said something to the effect of, you know, where he's looking for Nancy. Somewhere in this process, Paul Pelosi tries to kind of escape, goes into an elevator. There's an elevator in the home. And in that elevator, there is a phone. So he was trying to make a phone call. DePape doesn't let him get in the elevator, but somehow he convinces DePape to let him go to the bathroom. In the bathroom, apparently his phone is charging there, so he's able to call 911, and he speaks in code, something about how this guy is entering the house and what are you going to do to me. Somehow they end up going downstairs to the front door. I think Mr. Pelosi opens the door, knowing that the police are there, and at that moment, sooner on that moment, the police come in, and there's these two are struggling over the a hammer, and they tell them to let go of the hammer. Mr. Pelosi lets go of the hammer, and DePape actually takes the hammer and hits him on the head, and police rush in and arrest him.
Unbelievable. No, that's what I heard during the press conference as well. Exactly, yeah. That pattern of events, and that the police were shocked to watch as the hammer came down right on the top of Paul Pelosi's head, and he was rushed to the hospital. He's been in intensive care with his family at his side there. Rich McHugh, thanks for filling in the details. Appreciate that reporting.
Thanks, Ashley.
So the Secretary of Homeland Security said today that domestic violence extremism is one of the greatest threats that we face. And I don't think it's much of a surprise, frankly, if you just look back at some of the recent attacks on our political leaders, both Democrat and Republican. And this is just a really short list, like almost off the top of my head since 2020. Representative Pamela Jayapal, she's a Democrat from Washington State. She was a victim of stalking. And the man who was arrested allegedly threatened to kill her and, quote, send her back to India. And then conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh and his family had a scare when a man was arrested with a gun and a knife outside of his D.C. home. The man had allegedly made threats to kill a Supreme Court justice after the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade was leaked. And then there's Michigan's Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer. She was the target of a failed kidnapping plot in which 14 suspects were charged. And just last week, three of them were convicted and they face up to 20 years. A federal jury convicted two others. Two of them pleaded guilty, and two more were acquitted, and there are still others awaiting trial in that case. Republican member of Congress Lee Zeldin, attacked by a knife-wielding man during a campaign stop in New York this summer. Thankfully, he was not hurt. And then there's, of course, the January 6th violence, where thousands of crimes were committed at the U.S. Capitol building. A protester was shot dead. Police were assaulted, and several died later on. And the vice president's life was repeatedly threatened, as were Nancy Pelosi's and other members of Congress as well. There is no question tonight that the assault on Nancy Pelosi's husband this weekend was politically motivated. San Francisco police, the local DA, and the Federal Justice Department have all confirmed that. And they are unequivocally knocking down the wild conspiracy theories that somehow Paul Pelosi knew his attacker.
Can you clear it up once and for all? Did Paul Pelosi know his attacker?
There is absolutely no evidence that Mr. Pelosi knew this man. As a matter of fact, the evidence indicates the exact opposite.
But will the conspiracy theories stop, even though the officials have said absolutely not? And will those in positions of power decry the kind of dangerous rhetoric that leads up to attacks like this, and specifically this attack? Joining me now is Joe Lockhart. He is the former White House press secretary in the Bill Clinton administration. Tara Settmeyer is the senior advisor for the Lincoln Project. She's also a resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And finally, Paris Denard is a Republican strategist. He was also the White House director of Black Outreach during the George W. Bush administration. Welcome to all three of you. Joe Lockhart, I'm just going to get you to weigh in right off the bat to everything that you just heard from the top of the show, all those details.
Well, it's troubling and sad, but I think the word inevitable is probably the most powerful word to describe it. What's been going on since the Trump administration, and I lay much of this at former President Trump, radicalizing politics and normalizing behavior that's outside the realm of normal political discourse, and then acts like this. And, you know, I'll say, and I said loudly when Congressman Steve Scalise was shot, what a tragedy that was. And, you know, and I think I was joined by every Democrat I heard. We still have a sizable portion of the Republican Party who are saying that this didn't happen, or it happened in a way, and it's a false flag operation, just like they say the election didn't happen. And there's not a lot of leaders in the Republican Party willing to stand up to them, because they haven't been willing to stand up to Donald Trump. And this stuff is going to continue to happen unless some Republican leaders stand up and say, this just can't happen in our party.
So, Paris, I'm going to get you to jump in here as well, because there are a couple of things that I think should be addressed. For starters, Donald Trump Jr. retweeted something that was sent out, and this is what it said. "Got my Paul Pelosi Halloween costume ready," to which Don Jr. then added, "The internet remains undefeated." And the New York Times did an analysis of the number of times that Donald Trump referenced Speaker Pelosi in derogatory terms, and it was 800 times. And then Carrie Lake, who has been endorsed by Donald Trump, running, you know, in Arizona, said, made a joke at Pelosi's expense today at a campaign event and got a big laugh. So with all of that, you know, Joe Lockhart just said that this has sort of all been ginning up since the Donald Trump administration. I know you were in the administration, and I wonder how you respond to the fact that there is a lot of criticism that Donald Trump paved the way for this kind of dangerous rhetoric, and now the results of the dangerous rhetoric, actual, you know, injury and death.
Well, Donald Trump was not responsible for HBO putting an image of George W. Bush on his head on a spike on the Game of Thrones documentary. Donald Trump was not responsible for the Bernie Sanders supporter who had a hit list of Republicans that he was going to murder at the Republican congressional baseball game practice, which led to Congressman Steve Scalise being gravely injured along with others, including Capitol Police. You know, Donald Trump was not responsible for Kathy Griffin having a decapitated head of Donald Trump posted on Instagram. So I think we can point to a whole host of instances on both sides of the aisle where there has been senseless political attacks and violence that should not be the norm, should not be the standard, and should not happen in American society. I would push back on Mr. Lockhart saying that no Republican stood up against or vocalized against what happened to Mr. Pelosi. That's just flat out untrue. You had several people that were on news stations on Sunday morning in leadership, Republican leadership, denouncing it. Even President Trump called it a very terrible thing. So what we need to do is just be cognizant of the fact that we have to hold people accountable for the wrong actions that they do, especially as results to violence against anyone. There was a 30% increase in the San Francisco area as it stands where the attack took place. But outside of the violence that's growing in this country, the political violence should not be the case and should be denounced on both sides of the aisle, whether it's Republican or Democrat.
Yeah. So, Tara, I want you to jump in there because a lot of people are quick to blame Donald Trump and his he had, listen, very fiery rhetoric. I remember watching his campaign events where he, you know, said, throw the guy out of here. I'll pay for his legal bills, you know, take him out. And I remember that rhetoric, and it was shocking at the time. And now it sort of feels like just normal. But I think Paris makes a good point. I just listed off a list of both Democratic and Republican officials who've been targeted by members of the other side. So is it fair to blame Donald Trump, or are we just, as Americans, going down the toilet?
Well, I think it's a combination of overheated rhetoric, but I really cannot stomach the both sides-ism part of this, the whataboutism of this. It is, yes, were there isolated incidences on the left where there were attacks on Republicans? Yes, that's true. However, if we want to talk about holding people accountable, then I would hope that the Republican Party would hold Donald Trump accountable for inciting thousands of people to storm the Capitol in a violent insurrection in an attempt to overthrow our free and fair election based off of his repeated lies about the election. So I don't see Republicans being as upset about crime and as upset about an insurrection and a violent one incited by the leader of their party. So I find it a little bit rich that Republicans are all of a sudden so upset about crime when the leader of their party is involved in several cases and has potentially violated several federal statutes, stealing classified documents. But nobody's upset about that. Look, the FBI, our own Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have identified far right extremism as the most immediate threat to the homeland. This is not me talking. This is not politics talking. These are the professionals who do this for a living, whose job it is to protect this country. The FBI Director Christopher Wray testified in front of Congress and said that they've doubled their caseload in domestic violent far right extremism cases since 2020. This is a problem. It is coordinated and it stems from an entire ecosystem of far right individuals who are pushing conspiracy theories, who are pushing ethnic grievances, and you cannot be surprised when it manifests itself violently. I was part of the Republican Party at the time when Nancy Pelosi was public enemy number one back in 2010 and since then, and she was always the target, but the rhetoric was never violent. It was never about getting her. We saw what they were cheering at, what they were chanting on January 6th. On top of that, let's hang Mike Pence, they were also looking for Nancy Pelosi, and God knows what they would have, what that crowd would have done if they had gotten a hold of her.
So it brings me to the families of public officials. You know, forever and ever, children were off limits. Not so much anymore. I mean, there's loads of targets on the Trump children. They were in the administration. Granted, they're adult children. They were in the administration, so I understand the difference there. But with Paul Pelosi, he has been, he's been almost like a meme, like an avatar for right-wing networks to attack on a regular basis for the DUI that he had this summer. Let me just play a short little snippet of some of the things that the Fox News Network has been saying about Paul Pelosi. Take a look.
We know Nancy was out of town that night, and reports suggest Pauly P has always had a little bit of a wandering eye. Was it hanky-panky that caused the collision?
True, Biden's numbers are crashing like Nancy Pelosi's husband. So easy. Red meat.
He could have killed somebody, and he thinks that that's okay because of who he is and because of his stature. And it's the same way that Nancy Pelosi thought it was okay to tell everybody they had to wear masks, but when it came to her in the hair salon, she didn't feel that it was necessary to wear it. So I'm sick of this. I hope that he is prosecuted and to the full extent of the law. This is ridiculous.
So Joe Lockhart, that was just a very short little montage of the, the regular hits on Paul Pelosi. He's an 82-year-old man. He's now in intensive care. He, for all intents and purposes, should be dead, given what that man allegedly had and was prepared to do. But this isn't going to change, is it? I mean, the toothpaste is out of the tube on this one. I can't ask you as Pollyanna whether we're going to fix this in this country.
Well, no, and the problem right now is you should have the vast majority of the elected officials in Congress, Republicans, who still will not admit that Joe Biden was elected president legitimately. Almost 75% of them voted in Congress on a bill that said that the election was illegitimate. And when you start there, then this becomes the slippery and inevitable slope. When you start saying that democracy is no longer to be trusted. And I know a lot of people like to make comparisons. We've heard some of them tonight. I'd compare this, January 6th, and this to the year 2000. Al Gore lost by around 200 votes, and there's a lot of people who still believe the Supreme Court made a terrible decision there. Al Gore did not go out and say the election was stolen from him. He stood up there and he said, I'm going to work with the new president. There's no Democrat that I know who has said this any election, is illegitimate in the sense that we should overthrow it. You're certainly allowed to say, I think my guy got cheated, or I think, something happened. But this is where you're looking at the pictures right now. You're looking at what Donald Trump incited, his party incited, and the leaders of his party tolerated people saying, we're going to take everything into our own hands, and violence is acceptable. And when violence is acceptable on the Capitol, well, it's acceptable every place. And this is not, it is not something practiced by both parties. There are obviously individuals who take matters into their own hands, but there is only one party right now that has equivocated on violence, that has looked at these pictures and said, really, it was just a peaceful day. It was just a peaceful protest. There is no comparison right now between the parties, and the Republican Party bears sole responsibility for something like this and the atmosphere that condones violence in American politics right now.
Well, we are in the last run-up week to the midterms, and I know that this conversation is not over, but my time's up with you. Joe Lockhart, Tara Setmeyer, and Paris Tenor, thank you all three. Really appreciate your perspectives.
Thank you.
Still to come, he has been shunned by his partners and just about everybody else. But some of the fans who are sticking with Kanye West want the whole world to know it and to know why. And it's not about music. Welcome back. Big time college football rivalries have been known to attract the attention of law enforcement from time to time, but rarely like this. Today, the sheriff's office in Jacksonville, Florida, announced that it was well aware of this. Anti-Semitic messages flashing in lights on the outside of a downtown stadium after the Florida-Georgia game on Saturday. If you can't read it because it's blinking, it said Kanye was right about the Jews. And it wasn't the only place, as you can see, that the message was in lights. Those messages popped up in lights on other buildings around Jacksonville, too. Kanye was right about the Jews. And though it is not known who is responsible for this, the sheriff says no crimes are being committed with this. The messages do not include a threat, so they are protected by the First Amendment. Seeing it on banners all over the place, highways, and people sig-heiling above them. So it's the First Amendment. But, you know, there is also a freedom to condemn that kind of speech, which the mayor of Jacksonville promptly did. And so did the universities of Florida and Georgia and the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars. Of course, Kanye is free to continue spewing hate and inspiring other haters, too, even as the financial toll keeps rising for him. On Friday night, he did this. He regaled the paparazzi for 15 minutes, reading the definition of anti-Semitism and then brandishing that list you see there. It's a chart listing Jewish media executives. He has it right there on his phone. He's using it as a PowerPoint. He also compared himself to MLK and then also to Malcolm X. And then, remarkably, he compared himself to George Floyd in the most twisted attempt at an apology.
When I said that, and I questioned the death of George Floyd, it hurt my people. It hurt the black people. So I want to apologize to hurting them, because right now God has shown me by what Adidas is doing and by what the media is doing, I know how it feels to have a knee on my neck now.
Do you now? Really? So media and Adidas are the knee on your neck? Seriously? Remember, Kanye had falsely claimed that George Floyd died of a fentanyl overdose, for which the family is now threatening a $250 million lawsuit against him. In a now-deleted Instagram post, he called the mother of George Floyd's daughter greedy. He also posted a graphic picture of Emmett Till, the civil rights icon who was abducted and tortured and murdered and thrown in the Mississippi River back in 1955. We blurred the image here. Kanye did not do that. He tagged the powerful CEO of the William Morris Endeavor Talent Agency, Ari Emanuel, who'd written an op-ed calling on businesses to dump Kanye. So Kanye wrote, "This is what modern post-social media black mirror warfare looks like," using a reference to a British sci-fi series. He said he was being economically and digitally lynched, unlike the young Emmett Till, who was actually and literally lynched. And while Kanye's feelings may well be hurt and his fortune diminished, just take a look at your screen. Last year, there were more than 2,700 documented cases of assault, harassment, and vandalism against Jews across this country. And that is the most since the Anti-Defamation League began keeping track in 1979. Coming up next, a small town was shaken when two young friends were found murdered. And almost 6 years later, a brand new shock. The killer may have been living among them, lurking and lurking all that time. How did police never know? And what drew them to make an arrest now? I'll ask the host of the Hidden True Crime podcast when we come back. Election Night News Nation is here for you, the voter, taking you inside Decision Desk 2022. News Nation has partnered with Decision Desk HQ to provide independent race calls and analysis throughout the evening. And DDHQ is bringing their data operation here to News Nation headquarters in Chicago, allowing you to go behind the scenes with us as we crunch the numbers, track the turnout, and ask the questions that determine the key components that allow this Decision Desk HQ to make all those race call projections. It's pretty cool stuff. News Nation and Decision Desk HQ, the best political team on TV today, co-hosted by Chris Cuomo and Leland Vittert, and featuring our expert political panel. It all starts at 6 p.m. Eastern on election night, right here. News Nation, November 8th. So make sure you tune in right here. It's going to be an exciting night. So I don't know if you've been counting, but it has been more than 2,000 days since Libby German and Abigail Williams disappeared one afternoon while on an afternoon hike in the small town of Delphi, Indiana. Just 13 and 14 years old, respectively. It just made no sense when these two girls didn't show up at the meeting spot for their ride home. The next day, however, that mystery was solved, and the nightmare began for two local families. Abby and Libby's bodies were discovered in a ravine not far from where they'd been hiking. Back then, no one imagined just how difficult this was going to be to solve. Just an unthinkable crime. And almost 6 years of hunting for their killer, more than 70,000 tips, sketches of potential suspects released by the police, and even a grainy video that was captured by Libby German's cell phone, and the now infamous and chilling recording of a man's voice saying this. And still, year after year, no arrests until now. Today, police announced that 50-year-old Richard Allen has been charged with two counts of murder. A man who has lived in this community for at least 16 years. Allen worked at the local CVS, and according to family members, he even printed off the photos for the girls' funerals himself. Indiana State Police Superintendent Doug Carter was fighting back the tears today.
Today is not a day to celebrate, but the arrest of Richard M. Allen of Delphi on two counts of murder is sure a major step in leading to the conclusion of this long-term and complex investigation.
Family members of Abby Williams and Libby German were at that same press conference, too.
It was a kind of bittersweet, you know, it's, I just know that there's another job, another hill for us to climb ahead of us, but we're up for the challenge, and we're going to keep after it. We're not going to stop.
We still don't have a whole lot of information on the arrest yet, because the probable cause affidavit is sealed. But Richard Allen has never been named as a suspect before. He has no criminal record. He's also being held without bail, which is pretty serious. Police searched his home last week. They dug up his fire pit and they towed a vehicle, but they still won't say what they found. I'm joined now by Lauren Mathias. She has been working on this story as the host of the Hidden True Crime podcast. And Lauren, I mean, I have been working on this story also since 2017. And this just came as such a surprise. I really almost felt as though this is just going to be a cold case for a very long time. Do you have any further information on why this man, why now?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I think that question, Ashley, is what everybody is asking. You know, 2017, we're going on, but nearly 6 years, and why now? But what's interesting is what I think people aren't talking about is a 2019 news conference. State Police Superintendent Doug Carter at that news conference at that moment said, you know what? We're switching directions. And you know what? This man, this suspect, and he talked directly to him. He said, we know that you are hiding in plain sight. So why now?
Actually, you know what, Lori? But I think we actually dug that soundbite up. We dug that moment up. And it, again, like you said, this is Doug Carter, the man that you saw holding back the tears today, saying that this was not a day to celebrate, that they have a long road ahead of them. And this was the message in that news conference that he gave to the killer. Let's take a listen.
Directly to the killer, who may be in this room. We believe you are hiding in plain sight. For more than 2 years, you never thought we would shift gears to a different investigative strategy, but we have.
Okay, so that now looking back, I really wonder what the different investigative strategy was. Did they ever let on? Do we know what they did differently?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. He did say in that press conference, and I love that you had that soundbite because, like I said, no one's talking about this. He did say, we're switching directions at that moment. And he said, this person, he talked directly to the killer. He said, we believe that you're in Delphi or that you work in Delphi. We believe that you're watching, that you're nervous, that we switched directions. That's the day they put out a new sketch, and that's the day they put out the video of him and those words that Libby caught on her phone that were so important to this case. And so it does make you wonder what they learned at that moment and what they've been delving into. You know, they've been so tight-lipped on this case. We still do not know how those young girls died. We do not know how they were murdered.
That's the thing. So this is a thing that they have never revealed. And it's unusual because we usually hear if there's a sexual assault or if there's a, you know, a modus operandi of the killing, just to help maybe tweak what people might know or think about. And they have never done that. Have they ever said why they've been withholding that particular information?
Nothing beyond saying it's about the investigation and we need this information, which does go with that 2019 press conference. It's really telling now because I think that they did have an idea. And what they knew is that there was someone likely in the community that was nervous and that they needed to be able to have this evidence and what they knew very quiet, very not known, so that they could test the waters with the evidence and see what suspects come up and who knew what. And I think it really...
Lauren. It's really incredible if you think about it, that maybe in 2019 when he said that and said, we think you're hiding in plain sight, they've had eyes on him for 3 years, just waiting to collect what they needed to collect, just waiting for him to make, you know, one false move. Just a fascinating story. I'm going to have you back as we learn more because I think, you know, it's sealed for now, but those have an interesting way of being, you know, freedom of information opening. So will you come back and we'll talk about this as we learn more?
Thanks, Ashley.
So good to have you, Lauren. Thank you so much. Wow, what a story. Lauren Mathias covering it for us. Still ahead, you know, there is nothing quite like a Halloween scare, but there's plenty to haunt you all year long if you know just where to look. And after the break, we are hunting the scariest sites in America with the ghost hunter himself, Steve Gonzalez. He is next, live with me. If you like a good scare, Halloween night is your Super Bowl. But all year long, there are ghosts and ghouls just waiting for a chance to scare the living daylights out of you. And they're in some of the creepiest places across the country, like the Old City Jail in Charleston, South Carolina, where the conditions were so horrible back in the mid-1800s that travel expert Samantha Brown told the Washington Post she saw handprints appear on the wall during a tour, and she heard footsteps behind her when there was no one there. The CEO of a travel agency told the paper that the skull-lined catacombs in Paris gave her the fright of her life. Rani Chima says she was all alone down there, surrounded by the gated halls and the skulls lining the walls in total darkness. And her friend was convinced there was a family of ghosts following her. For my next guest, however, that's the stuff that's kind of all in a day's work. Steve Gonzalez is a paranormal investigator and host of Ghost Hunters on the Travel Channel. And he's visited over 1,000 locations in search of paranormal action. And he's here live with me on Halloween night. See, this is such a great time to meet up with you. But for those who want Halloween all year long, where are the best places to go for some one-on-one time with a ghost?
You know, there are a lot of places people can visit themselves. Off the top of my head, a lot come to mind. Waverly Hills in Louisville, Kentucky. And that is a place where thousands of people died in just a short period of time. And so many so that they needed to construct a chute that they named the Death Tunnel just to get the bodies out and to keep the morale in the property up. And that place has a high frequency of activity, and the activity is pretty intense. They're not afraid of you there at Waverly Hills. And a little side note also is that a woman sadly took her own life by hanging, and that was over a bit of a squabble with a doctor who's trying to keep their relationship under wraps. So that Ooh. Is another thing that people could encounter there, and that happens on the very top floor. But that place, high degree of activity. So
let me ask you about the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, which was the inspiration for Stephen King's The Shining. I have heard that Suite 217 is booked solid every Halloween, and it's got lots of activity.
It really does. The Stanley Hotel, it really did scare Stephen King himself. He had some encounters while staying there, and that inspired him to write the book. But we had a lot of encounters there, disembodied voices and sounds, electronic voice phenomena, voices answering questions. I've had a cold spot phenomena there where it feels like I'm putting my arm in cold jello. Very, very strange. And that's a place with a high frequency of activity as well. So if people want to visit there, their chances of having an experience are pretty high.
Okay, I've got 20 seconds left, but tell me about the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum for the Criminally Insane in Weston, West Virginia.
Yeah, that place is for the criminally insane, not just criminals or the insane, but the criminally insane. That's a place you can go to. And there are stories like there was a patient who gouged somebody's eyes out and put his head under a bedpost and jumped on the bed until his head popped like a melon. And that's the kind of energy you're dealing with there. Very grisly, but sadly, part of our history. And history is something that does spark a haunting phenomenon.
There's just no one I would rather to spend Halloween night with than you. Steve Gonzalez, thanks so much. And I should promote that Ghost Hunters airs on Saturday on the Travel Channel, and you've got a really cool one coming up with the Battleship New Jersey in Camden this Saturday. Thanks for being here, and happy Halloween.
Thank you. Happy Halloween.
Ooh. Okay. So, folks, it's a rite of passage on Halloween. You dress up, you go door to door, you fill your bag with candy. But this year, a record number of us decided to skip handing out the treats. All due to inflation? After the break, can you guess how many of us stiffed the trick-or-treaters? Big surprise coming next. Welcome back. For many of us across the country, Halloween 2022 has come and gone tonight. And one of the highlights, no need for social distancing like in the last 2 years. Even so, to get around the COVID hurdle, this is my house. My family decorated a 10-foot-long PVC pipe to shoot candy bars down to the trick-or-treaters below, because that is what you do, my friends, when the going gets tough and the show must go on. I must say, I was extraordinarily proud of this, my husband and I creating that PVC pipe. The kids loved it, too. But this year, it is a different story. A record number of Americans have decided to throw in the sheet on giving out candy. A whopping 52% of Americans played Halloween Scrooge to the trick-or-treaters on their street. One in four of them said inflation made the candy too expensive. And folks, they are not wrong. The Bureau of Labor Statistics said candy prices are up almost 13% from last year. That is the biggest one-year increase ever. What remains to be seen, though, is if the little goblins ponied up for the toilet paper to play a trick on the Halloween Grinches, who decided to skip out on the candy. We'll see, though. Find out what the neighborhood looks like tomorrow. And speaking of tomorrow, there is something interesting if you're watching your television. A lot of Democratic candidates across the country have decided on a campaign in this last week leading up to the election on Tuesday, midterms, to start running ads about the Republican opponents if they had any involvement in January 6th. So keep your eyes peeled if you and your community start seeing Democratic ads pointing out that guy, my opponent, had something to do with January 6th. It is sort of like a nationwide thing that the Democrats are doing. And I think you can spot it if you're looking. Also tonight, coming up, Congresswoman Debbie Dignall is going to join Chris Cuomo to talk about the attack on Paul Pelosi and keeping our elected officials safe. Cuomo gets started right now, so I'll see you tomorrow night.